We are talking with John M. Berry. He is a distinguished visiting scholar at the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane and Xavier University. He is also author of the new book, The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History. John, thanks for spending time with us today.
It really is my pleasure.
If you would start out and tell us what was the motivation in writing your book, The Great Influenza.
Well, this may seem like an odd reason, but what I think that in my own head I write about is power and how people use it or abuse it and how a society functions. And I think that when you look at a society, an individual, an institution, or a society in crisis, it's easier to understand that society under great pressure. So I wanted to look at how people responded, both the larger society, the people in political power, and in the case of the influenza pandemic, also scientists who were trying to handle this pandemic. So it may seem an odd aspect to take, but I really see the book, or it's a story of the first collision of modern science and epidemic disease. And if you think that the scientists were not modern in 1918, you need to rethink that. They were extraordinary scientists. One person in the book won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for work that he actually did in 1911. He was 55 years ahead of the curve. Another scientist discovered that polio was a viral disease in 1907. In 1908, he developed a vaccine 100% effective in protecting monkeys against polio. Another scientist got the mortality rate for bacterial meningitis down to 18% in 1910 without antibiotics. Today, at Massachusetts General Hospital, one of the best hospitals in the world, the mortality rate for the same disease is 25%. 18% in 1910, today it's actually higher with antibiotics and great intensive care units for the same disease, patients in the same circumstances. So these were extraordinarily able scientist, and one of my heroes in the book, a personal hero of mine, he's sort of an inspirational figure to me, named Oswald Avery, who is a direct result of his research that started on influenza, although he was studying the pneumococcus. He was the person who ultimately discovered that DNA carries the genetic code, although that discovery didn't come for 25 years, but the book does follow through that. And Jim Watson, Peter Medawar, Max Delbruck, Salvador Luria, all of them, Nobel Prize winners, McFarlane Burnett, another Nobel laureate, I quote all of them saying that, well, one said that Avery's work was the most important biological experiment of the 20th century, and they all credit Avery with almost inventing the field of molecular biology and a direct result of the influenza pandemic and the research he did. So these people were tremendous scientists, and when they took on a problem, they knew how to approach it and cut through it, and the people who ran the government were not quite so effective.
Start us out and walk us through the when and where the epidemic began.
Okay, well, it's important to understand that all influenza viruses come from birds. All influenza starts in birds. But the influenza virus is one of the most rapidly mutating viruses in existence. It's one of a group of viruses that virologists call, their technical term, oddly enough, is a mutant swarm. Because there's never an individual, even a subtype. They just mutate around sort of a mean. And this enormous mutation rate, a million times faster, literally a million times faster than a DNA virus, the mutation rate, allows the virus to periodically jump species. And about as far back as we can reasonably diagnose influenza from symptoms, descriptions of symptoms, which goes at least five centuries and probably a good deal further back. From 3 to 5 times a century, an influenza virus has jumped from birds to people and then mutated in a way that allows it to pass from person to person. And whenever that happens, nobody's immune system in the world will be able to recognize that virus and defeat it so it spreads explosively and you have a pandemic. As I say, generally 3 to 5 times a century. There were 3 in the 20th century, 1968, 1957, both of which were serious, but nothing like 1918, and then 1918 itself. And it seems likely, although it's impossible to prove precisely where it started, but the best evidence is that it actually started in Kansas, which is a very unlikely site of origin, but that's where the evidence points. And at first, there was a mild spring wave that people didn't really notice. But all this time, the virus was in a new environment. It had just jumped species. It took it a while to become really at home in humans. And over a period of 6 to 8 months, it became increasingly efficient at attacking humans and infecting them. And then all of a sudden, and by this time it had spread all over the world, initially it went from rural Kansas with draftees to what is now Fort Riley, then about 56,000 troops. And, of course, from Fort Riley, it spread with American troops to Europe and to other bases, and pretty soon it was all around the world. And then in late August, early September, it just exploded in lethal form. The press generally refers to 1918's death toll as, quote, over 20 million, unquote. The reality is that that was a number that was a contemporary estimate. It was actually fairly accurate for Europe and the United States, but it was wildly inaccurate for the entire world. And the reality is that a Nobel Prize winner who spent most of his life studying influenza, McFarland Burnett, concluded that the real death toll was a minimum of 50 million people, and possibly as many as 100 million people. And this was in a world with a population only 28% as big as today. So you adjust for population, it's the equivalent of 175 to 325 million people. And even without adjusting for population, it moved so rapidly in a period of 24 weeks, it killed more people than AIDS has killed in the 24 years that AIDS has been a serious public health problem.
So am I correct in understanding that there was like 3 waves of this disease? Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Right. The first wave, as I said a minute ago, the virus entered the population. It was in a new environment. Like any organism in a new environment, it had to adapt or die. So it was not very efficient at infecting people. It was gradually getting more and more at home. So that first wave was a mild wave. And in fact, it was so mild, although it was noticed, there were actual articles in medical journals saying this cannot be influenza because it's too mild, and we don't see any of the complications we usually get with influenza. And that one of the articles the book quotes was published on July 13th, 1918. Less than 8 weeks later, people were again saying this can't possibly be influenza because it's too lethal and the symptoms are too extreme compared to any influenza we've ever seen before. But it was influenza, and the symptoms were often horrific. Let me read you a letter from one physician at Camp Devens, which was outside of Boston, and was the first Army base in the United States hit by the lethal form of the epidemic in the second wave. First, let me explain. Cyanosis is when you turn blue from lack of oxygen. Normally, that's just a slight bluish tinge around the lips and extremities. But this is Dr. Roy Grist, he's writing a colleague. He said, "These men start with what appears to be an ordinary attack of La Grippe or influenza. And when brought to the hospital, they very rapidly develop the most vicious type of pneumonia that has ever been seen. 2 hours after admission, they have the mahogany spots over the cheekbones, and a few hours later, you can begin to see the cyanosis extending from the ears and spreading all over the face until it is hard to distinguish the colored men from the white." That's how deep this cyanosis was. He couldn't tell races apart. "It is only a matter of a few hours, then, until death comes. It is horrible. One can stand it to see 1, 2, or 20 men die, but to see these poor men dropping like flies. We've been averaging about 100 deaths per day. Pneumonia means, in about all cases, death, We've lost an outrageous number of nurses and doctors. It takes special trains to carry away the dead. For several days there were no coffins, and the bodies piled up something fierce. It beats any sight they ever had in France after a battle. Goodbye, old pal. God be with you till we meet again. That was at Camp Devens. The experience was replicated at essentially every military base, not only in the U.S. Army or Navy, but foreign forces as well, and very soon it leaked into the civilian population. And in addition to the cyanosis, which physicians who treated then and then went on to practice for 50, 60 years said they never saw cyanosis as intense as they did then, some of the other symptoms were so unusual for influenza that it was initially misdiagnosed as cholera, as typhoid, as dengue, which is known as breakbone fever, to give you an idea of those symptoms. And people could bleed in some of the Army bases. 20% of the soldiers were bleeding from their nose or mouth. And more rarely, but definitely reported, some people could even actually bleed from their ears and even their eyes. So these were terrifying symptoms. As bad as that is, the overwhelming majority of people who got influenza, even in 1918, suffered the same kind of attack that we're all familiar with today. They had a terrible 3 or 4 days. A week later, they're fine. But there was this minority, and it was not a tiny minority, that had this other entirely different experience, which we just described.
And give us a sense for how many people were actually infected with this back then.
Well, it's hard to say. In the United States, there was, after the disease, there was a careful epidemiological study, not of the whole country. The vital statistics weren't good enough, but they picked out about 25 cities and looked very closely at them, sometimes often doing door-to-door surveys. And the attack rate ranged from a low of around 20% to a high in San Antonio of over 50%, actually 53%. So that in San Antonio, literally 98% of all the homes in San Antonio had at least one person sick with influenza. Now, fortunately, in San Antonio, the virus happened to be particularly mild for the 1918 virus, or the death toll would have been astronomical there.
And then you have places like in villages in Alaska where it would wipe out 85% of the people?
In some cases, literally, well, first, more than half the death toll, well over half the death toll, were young adults, people aged between 20 and 35. And the reason for that was that your immune system changes over time, and the immune system is strongest when you're a young adult, normally most resistant to any infectious disease. But what was happening was they were being infected by the virus, and the immune system didn't recognize it. And the immune system, therefore, was throwing every weapon it had at the virus. And the immune system has some very, very lethal weapons. In the battlefield, where all these explosions of artillery, so to speak, were going off, was your lung. So the immune system was destroying the lung while it was trying to get at the virus in the lung. And this is what was killing all the young people. But within that demographic group, people in cities were actually safer, in a sense, than people in the country, because people in cities had at least seen some influenza viruses, and that they got a little bit of cross-protection, actually considerable cross-protection. And what scientists call truly, quote, virgin populations, unquote, areas where they had never seen an influenza virus, this was absolutely deadly. So in places like Alaska, you could go into the villages and see 100% mortality. Now, that was not all because of the virus. Many people died of the virus, but they also died because everyone got sick at the same time, and therefore there was no one to care for them, no one to keep them, give them water, feed them, and so forth. But the same thing was also true in it wasn't just the weather in Alaska. The same thing was true in Africa, where after the virus passed through, people went into and saw villages of hundreds of people, 100% mortality. Give you a graphic example of the different populations, how it affected. In Guam, where there was a major U.S. naval installation, the virus struck there. Out of several thousand sailors, there was only a single fatality. By this time, the virus, it was, you'd asked earlier about waves, the third wave was much milder. This was a third wave attack with a relatively mild virus, at least compared to the one in the fall. It had mutated in that direction. It only killed one sailor. However, more than 10% of the entire native population in Guam was dead because they had never seen an influenza virus of any kind at all, ever before. So even the mild mutant form of this virus then killed more than 10% of the entire population.
So that was one of the unique aspects of this particular influenza virus, was the fact that it attacked the young and healthy.
Right. I mean, all influenza viruses are going to attack all age groups. But this was particularly lethal, and the reason and particularly efficient at attacking everybody. However, it was the strength of the immune system and the overreaction of the immune system that was killing all the young people. Normally, in an influenza outbreak every year, those young adults are the least likely to get a bad attack and the least likely to die. Normally, infants and the elderly who have weak immune systems are the victims of influenza, but it was the absolute, well, infants suffered greatly in 1918, but young adults was the real target of the virus.
And technically, how does the virus kill people? What does it do to people that causes them to die?
Well, it invades a cell. It's called epithelial cells, which line all your mucosal membranes from the mouth all the way down into the lungs. I mean, even the physical setup of the immune system, the way your windpipe works, air that you inhale has to bounce off various places. And those membranes are so effective that even though your lung obviously is exposed directly numerous times a minute every time you take a breath to outside air, the lung is actually sterile under normal circumstances. So just the physical blocking of the by these epithelial cells, which line the passageways, is tremendously effective. And the virus, however, wipes out these cells entirely. There's a photograph in the book of a healthy trachea versus one 72 hours after the virus hits. And the healthy trachea of these cells, it looks like a jungle, totally bush-covered. I mean, they look like bushes. And 72 hours later, it's a desert. There's nothing left. So the virus can go all the way into the lungs, down this path of cells, from passing from one cell to another. If it gets to the lungs and you develop viral pneumonia even today is likely to be 40 to 60% fatal. And that's with massive support in intensive care unit. If you don't get that support, then it's essentially 100% fatal. So you can die, could die either directly from the viral, a massive viral, people were dying sometimes in less than 24 hours. Those people suffered massive viral pneumonias. The pneumonia just basically knocked out everything in the lung. Then you had another sequence of people who were dying between 24 hours and, say, 96 hours, 2 to 4 or 5 days maybe. Those people were dying because their immune system was counterattacking the virus. And then after that, you then had a second sequence when the body was so weakened and the immune system was so exhausted, bacteria simply marched into the lung unimpeded and people developed bacterial pneumonia. And they would die 2-3 weeks later. Sometimes they would get up, go back to work, and then be attacked by bacterial pneumonia and die from that. But that would take several weeks.
And did the bulk of the deaths occur in the second wave?
The second wave killed probably 75 to 80% of all the deaths from 1918 were in a matter of weeks, really. It would take 6 to 10 weeks to go through a particular area. And between mid-September of 1918 and January of 1919, you had probably three-quarters of the total death toll. 1919, the third wave struck. And it, I guess you could actually say there were fourth and fifth waves in 1920 and 1921. They're generally not technically considered waves of the pandemic, but I guess they really are.
So when these mutations occur from wave to wave, from the first one to the second one was a dramatic increase in, what would you call it, virility?
Virulence.
Virulence, okay. And then the third one, it dropped off. Is that...
One of the reasons for that is it's simple natural selection. Because if the virus is killing somebody in 24 hours, then there's no opportunity for that virus to propagate itself and infect somebody else. So that most lethal form of the virus is dying off. And it sort of reaches a state of equilibrium with people where it's going through them but not killing them so rapidly that it can't continue its own existence. And, I mean, there were a couple of reasons why it became milder. Another one was, once it had gone around the world once, people's immune systems could recognize it and fight more effectively against it without over-responding. Normally, the immune system is very specific and, you know, aims a laser. Initially, in 1918, they were throwing just every laser they had that would hit at any target. But by 1919, the immune system knew specifically what to do naturally, so it became more effective. And, of course, that became more true in 1920, 1921. Also, the virus itself, most influenza viruses are nothing like the lethality of 1918, and the virus itself was mutating in the direction of most influenza viruses. It was becoming more mild in and of itself.
So talk about some of the responses. I guess we could start with what was the response of governments at the time?
Well, I think to understand what happened, particularly in the United States and Europe, you need to understand the context. And the context was we were at war. And it was the first total war. The Wilson administration, Wilson called for, quote, ruthless brutality to enter into every phase of American life, unquote. That was Wilson's goal. And he wanted to turn everything in the country toward the war. And to do this, first he had passed a law which would make the Patriot Act look like a resolution of the American Civil Liberties Union. Let me quote this law. It makes it punishable by 20 years in jail to, quote, utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government of the United States, unquote. Now, this was a pretty intimidating piece of legislation. You notice it didn't say anything in there about truth. You could tell the truth, but if you criticize the government, they could still send you to jail. They sent a United States congressman to jail for 10 years. So they went around enforcing this law. And while they are, on the one hand, intimidating people into so that there'd be no criticism of the government, at the same time, they very actively mounted a propaganda campaign, something they called the Committee for Public Information. And let me read you what one of the architects of this committee said. Quote, truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. There is nothing in experience to tell us that one is preferable to the other. The force of an idea lies in its inspirational value. It matters very little if it is true or false. Unquote. So this is the attitude of somebody who's behind the government information effort that the Wilson administration is putting out. And, of course, the purpose of all this is to generate morale, keep morale up, keep people patriotic, keep people out there going to the factories if they're sick, just, you know, doing everything they can to win the war. So you have the intimidation on one hand and an active effort to, you know, they did not care whether it was a lie or not. On the other hand, to get information out. Now, I'm originally from Providence, Rhode Island, and the Providence Journal, above the headline, the title, Providence Journal, every day had a banner headline that said, every Austrian or German should be considered a spy unless you've known them for decades. That was the attitude in the country. And it was important because when the virus struck in the fall, even though this is, we're talking about 10, 8, 6, sometimes even fewer, with 3 weeks before the end of the war. By September, practically all the countries we were fighting World War I, except for Germany itself, had stopped fighting. Some had were formally sued for peace. Germany had already sent out peace feelers. It was clear we had won, or at least to those in the know, and obviously Wilson knew, and the Army General Staff knew. Nonetheless, the attitude they took toward influenza was to lie about it, because that's what they did. They were afraid that telling the truth about the disease would frighten people and hurt morale. And in fact, this epidemic is commonly referred to Spanish influenza. And there are several theories about where it started. I personally think, and I think the best evidence is, it started in the United States. But there are other ideas as to where it may have started. But no one thinks it started in Spain. The reason it's called Spanish influenza is Spain was not at war, and therefore its newspapers were not censored, and therefore they were writing about the disease, and it became known as Spanish influenza. But back to the impact of the effort to control thought, what that meant was that when influenza hit, the local governments, and they were very much working with the federal government, would first deny that it was a problem, and then say, you can take care of yourself, and then say, you know, we've got it licked. For example, the Chicago Public Health Commissioner said, our first requirement is to keep the people from fear. Worry kills more than the disease. That's a direct quote. You would see in newspaper all around the country, they would put little boxes, don't be scared. Fear kills more than the disease. But at the same time, the Chicago Public Health Commissioners say worry kills more than the disease. The mortality rate at Cook County Hospital for influenza admissions was 39%. Or in Philadelphia, for example, you literally, the city was completely overwhelmed. The health system collapsed. In Philadelphia, you literally had priests driving horse-drawn carts through the street, calling upon people to bring out their dead. And they were using steam shovels to dig mass graves, enrolling people into these mass graves without coffins, because every city in the country ran out of coffins. So what happens, on the one hand, all you're hearing from public authorities is, don't worry, normal precautions will prevent you from getting influenza, and this isn't really serious anyway, and everything's okay, just don't get scared, and everything will be fine. That's what you're hearing on the one hand from authority, and on the other hand, you're seeing your neighbor die in 24 hours. Your spouse may be lying in the bed next to you dead for 4 or 5 days before anybody can get the body out. And the symptoms that I described earlier are sometimes horrific. So very quickly, people lost all trust in public authorities. And personally, I think ultimately society is based on trust. And without trust, society began to disintegrate. The terror, according to many internal Red Cross documents, and Red Cross workers were unbelievably heroic in this, but according to their internal documents, instance after instance where you see a Red Cross worker saying this is what it was like in the plague of the Middle Ages. Back to Philadelphia, for example, I quoted one, he was then a medical student. The med school, of course, was dismissed. He was put in charge of an entire emergency hospital where every day 20% of his patients died, every night. And he lived 12 miles from the hospital. And he went home every night, and the streets were so quiet, although Philadelphia is a city of almost 2 million people, he started counting the cars on the road. And one night, in a distance of 12 miles in a city of 2 million people, he did not pass a single other car on the road. He said the life of the city has almost stopped. And there's a photograph of downtown Manhattan during the day. There are a couple of sanitation workers wearing masks in the picture, but the amazing thing is there's not a car on the street, and there's not a pedestrian on the sidewalk. There are cars parked at the curb, but there's nothing moving because people were terrified and they just stopped cold.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with John M. Barry. He is author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. John, so tell us, what then was the reaction of science and the medical community? You had started out and told us that the medical community was actually fairly advanced by that time.
Right. They knew all the fundamentals. They obviously didn't know everything that we know now, but they knew how the immune system worked. They didn't have antibiotics, but they were very, very good at doing what they did know, which was vaccines to prevent something and serum to treat it. And they, as I said earlier, they even got the, using serum, they actually got the death rate for men and bacterial meningitis down to lower in 1910 than it is today at Mass General Hospital. So there was this mad rush, and the book does focuses on a handful of these scientists to identify whatever was causing the disease. And they believed if they could identify it, they could develop either a vaccine or a serum and at least begin to handle it. Of course, it was 24-hour-a-day work. At the same time, you know, your technicians are you don't know what technician is going to die or be sick, and you know, there's tremendous courage involved, people literally going into autopsy rooms wading through blood. As I said earlier, one of the symptoms was that people would bleed from their ears, eyes, as well as their nose and mouth. So particularly in the army camps, and we were at war again, it was total war. That meant that essentially every scientist in the United States was in the military. The entire Rockefeller Institute, which is now Rockefeller University, was simply incorporated en masse into the United States Army. But these people would go into autopsy rooms literally wading through blood on the floor on their way into the rooms, and then try to figure out, looking at the organs, what they could learn there, then trying to culture whatever is causing these deaths. So I give great credit to, and these people were heroic, and they actually began to make some progress. But the disease moved so rapidly, of course they couldn't catch up with it. And they also were pretty much unable, under the circumstances, to do the kind of controlled scientific experiments which are, you know, need to be highly disciplined to yield an answer. So some of them, while they felt ethically they could not conduct these controlled experiments, if they thought they had a vaccine that might work, it simply wasn't appropriate to withhold it from people simply for a scientific experiment. But some of the findings that came out of this effort, well, number one, if you take a shot today, a vaccine against pneumonia, which is a pneumococcal, a bacteria, not the influenza virus, but it still causes pneumonia, that is a direct descendant, straight line descendant of work that was done at this time. In addition, in terms of just more basic science, the distinction between what a virus is and what a bacteria is, that was made soon after the epidemic by one of these people that I was focusing on, a guy named Tom Rivers, who actually was going to be a pediatrician until the epidemic started, and he got into science and made really one of the, you know, more important some discoveries. And then, of course, later, earlier I talked about he worked on it for 25 years, but as a direct outgrowth of this research, Oswald Avery discovered that DNA carried the genetic code and is so credited by Watson and Crick and half a dozen other Nobel laureates whom I named, with really pointing them to this discovery and, to a certain extent, starting the field of modern molecular biology.
So am I correct in understanding then, basically, they never did really nip it in the bud? It just Mother Nature died out.
They were not about to nip it in the bud, nor could we today, frankly. We're not yet ready for that, unfortunately, which is part of the problem. To a certain extent, and maybe to a considerable extent, actually, 1918 is a case study of what can happen in a major new outbreak of any disease, really, or to a major bioterrorism attack, both in terms of how you need to respond to it for public health officials and government authorities, as well as within the scientific community. And since the book's come out, I've actually become I've dealt with people at the World Health Organization who run their influenza program and the CDC, and as well as the Department of Defense, and for that matter, even had some conversations with people at the CIA. Obviously, there is a concern out there now about another influenza virus. The National Academy of Sciences says that another pandemic is, quote, not only inevitable but overdue, unquote. So the situation is potentially dangerous. And I think learning about what happened in the past points away towards some of the things we need to do now. The most important thing, really, and the most obvious lesson from what happened in 1918 is that governments need to tell the truth about public health. And it sounds so simple, and yet governments don't like to tell the truth because whenever it makes them look bad. But it's not only governments. You know, individuals don't like to admit error. Neither do corporations. It's a human trait. You don't like to admit failing. But the World Health Organization, for example, has in place a surveillance system actively looking for the next virus that's going to jump species from birds to people and become the new pandemic influenza virus. And when SARS hit in 2003, they were able to jump on that and contain it because they already had an existing infrastructure built for influenza. And they initially thought that was the new influenza virus. Fortunately, it wasn't. But going back to telling the truth, China lied about SARS for 2 months for many of the same reasons that the Wilson administration lied in 1918, because they didn't want to upset people. They didn't want to hurt morale. They didn't want to admit that anything was going wrong, that something wasn't perfect. But if SARS had been influenza instead of what it was, and it got a new 2 month head start, we would not have a chance in the world of getting ahead of the disease. It just moves too fast. But SARS actually is much less dangerous than influenza because a SARS patient is most contagious well after he develops symptoms. And it also requires much greater exposure before someone else will catch it. So first you have an opportunity to identify and isolate and quarantine somebody who's got SARS. And second, again, it takes much greater exposure to get the disease. Influenza has been called by infectious disease experts, quote, a special case among infectious diseases, unquote, because it is so contagious, so easy to get, and also because people can infect others before they show any symptoms whatsoever. So you can't quarantine somebody who's not showing any symptoms. Or it's just harder to isolate, and even though under normal circumstances most influenza viruses have a much lower mortality rate than SARS did, the current bird flu in Asia is different. That's much higher. But because it infects so many people, it still has, you know, the death toll mounts up.
Can you tell us about the status and the history with vaccine production dealing with this? Because currently we're looking at, just in this last season, we had two corporations that were producing the vaccine, right, for flu, and one of them had a problem and had, what, 48 million doses taken off the market.
Right.
Has it always been that way, where it's been a limited number of private companies that have been in charge of that?
Well, in the United States, it's always been pretty much private companies, although actually historically, and it's kind of interesting, in the book I talk about the people who developed the diphtheria antitoxin, which we still use today, was actually the New York City Public Health Department. Anna Williams and William Park did that, and they initially supplied it for free and so forth until pharmaceutical manufacturers complained to the New York City politicians, Tammany Hall and so forth, put an end to it. But generally, it's always been a private operation in the United States. And the number of vaccine manufacturers has gone down, down, and down. And now it's really pretty small. I was at a workshop in October with the CEOs of several international vaccine manufacturers, including from India and Brazil, as well as the CEOs of one U.S. company and representatives from other U.S. manufacturers, along with the World Health Organization and the European Community and HHS and so forth. And they were discussing the problems in the United States. So the purpose of the workshop was to try to figure out a plan should a new pandemic virus strike and how to deal with the vaccines. And there's been a lot of talk about liability as a cause for the disappearance of American vaccine manufacturers. But somebody asked the CEO of an American company, direct question, is it liability that the reason there are so few left? And his response was that liability is an aggravation and an irritant, but it's not really why companies were getting out of the business. At least in influenza, the profit margin was small, and they ended up routinely throwing away millions of doses of vaccine because people didn't take them. And he said if you could get a predictable demand, then you would get an adequate vaccine supply. The one good thing about what happened last year was it drew tremendous attention to the need to reform and rebuild the infrastructure of vaccine manufacturing, not only in the U.S., but around the world, but particularly in the U.S. I mean, another thing that came out of this workshop was an estimate that 6 months after a new influenza pandemic virus, a new virus jumping from birds to people, was identified, that there would only be 100 million doses of vaccine in the world. And, of course, there are over 6 billion people in the world. We don't make that many doses in the United States. It was a unanimous feeling of the people there that not a single country in the world would export a single dose of vaccine until its own population was taken care of. So, obviously, we need to fix the vaccine infrastructure. The reality is, I am not a fan of the Bush administration. I'm pretty much despise the Bush administration, to be blunt. However, on influenza, and despite the fact that this disaster with the vaccine manufacturer occurred on their watch, on influenza, they're doing a very good job. They have actually increased influenza spending 1,000% since 2001. And the reason is a very senior HHS official said to me, we do not want to see a 9/11 commission report coming in a few years asking why we didn't prepare for the next influenza pandemic. So that's one thing that they are doing well. But they need more support. And the World Health Organization needs more support.
Well, do you think vaccine production should just be taken over by the government since the profit motive for corporations doesn't seem to inspire them?
That's one solution. It's not necessarily the only solution. You could guarantee the market the way they do with a lot of farm subsidies. They could also change the recommendations to CDC, which is likely to happen, to recommend that all Americans get influenza vaccine. That recommendation would likely increase the market. They're not prepared to do that now because Chiron, the manufacturer that failed to deliver the doses last year, is not ready this year. I mean, that plan is not going to be in operation next year. So the most doses that the U.S. is going to have next year will be in the realm of 70, 75 million, as opposed to the 100 million they needed for the old recommendations. So they're not yet prepared to say everybody should get it. But if they did something like that, that might increase the market to the extent that they'd take care of it. There are other things, improving and changing the vaccine production technology. It's now made through millions and millions and millions of eggs. It's been made that way since the 1930s. And there are much more iron technologies, which would also cut the time that it takes to produce a vaccine, but although it would not cut more than a few weeks out of the process. So, and to give this administration credit, they are investing in that. The House of Representatives used to cut their request in half, but given what happened last year, that was the silver lining of the vaccine disaster last fall, is the House of Representatives gave them what they wanted for a change and will probably continue to fund it fully.
We only have a few minutes left, so what final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to talk about two people. in the book, Oswald Avery and Paul Lewis. Oswald Avery, I mentioned earlier, was the person who ultimately discovered that DNA carries a genetic code by studying the pneumococcus and outgrowth of his influenza research. Avery, however, I mean, it was not a straight line of, you know, success after success. When I started this book, I thought it was going to take me at most 3 years and that I could probably do it in 2.5 years. Instead, it took me 7. There was many a time that I wanted to throw the entire book out the window and all my work. But I live from the advance that the publisher gives me. I had already cashed a check, and I couldn't. I was stuck. And Avery was in a similar situation. He was so stymied by this problem that the pneumococcus presented that he didn't really know how to approach or how to solve. And he kept picking away at it. But over a period of 11 years, he only published a single scientific paper. And I'm not sure you can quite, unless you're a scientist, understand what, I mean, most scientists, even then, much less today, they publish hundreds of papers. So to publish one paper in 11 years, it's like a football coach who goes 1-45. He just loses game after game, year after year. And Avery got very depressed over it. He, too, wanted to throw all his experiments out the window. But he stuck with it, and he said, failure is my daily bread. I thrive on it. The reality is he didn't thrive. Even at one point, he actually had essentially a nervous breakdown and had to quit research. But he also said, whenever you fall down, pick up something. So all these failures that he was having with his experiments, he was learning something from them. And ultimately, of course, as I've said about 3 times already, he came up with what Nobel laureate Peter Medawar called the most important biological experiment of the 20th century when he proved that DNA carries a genetic code. The other character is Paul Lewis. And his story moved me to the extent that I actually, at my wife's suggestion, dedicated the book to his spirit. And Lewis started out as an extraordinarily promising scientist. In fact, 2 scientists alive today, whose fathers were also scientists and knew Lewis entirely independent. One knew him at the Rockefeller Institute. One person worked at the Pasteur Institute. They know dozens of Nobel Prize winners. They themselves were prize-winning scientists. 2 different sources said Lewis was the smartest person they had ever met. And despite his great promise, and actually one of the things that he was doing, some of his work inspired some of the possibly successful scientific work that may actually have done something during the influenza epidemic. But after the pandemic, his scientific successes became fewer and fewer. He was offered great jobs, but they were administrative jobs building scientific institutions at the University of Iowa, for example. And he turned them down because all he wanted to do was stay in the laboratory. And ultimately, he was told flat out when he was given another great job offer, take the job because we are going to fire you. He was at the Rockefeller Institute. And instead of taking the job, he declined it. Again, he wanted to stay in the laboratory. And he volunteered to go to Brazil to solve a yellow fever problem. And he died of yellow fever there. And the reality is, I think there's very good evidence that he committed suicide. In the book, I go into exactly why I think his problem in approaching, he couldn't really define a scientific problem in a way that he could get into it, whereas Avery was also faced with what seemed to be insurmountable scientific problems, but he was able to redefine little pieces of it so he could get answers. So those 2 people, I think, sort of carried me through the book, and I might even have thought of suicide myself more than once during the course of it, but fortunately I found my inspiration in Avery rather than in Lewis. And the other irony about Paul Lewis is while he is in Brazil giving himself yellow fever, dying from a, quote, laboratory accident, unquote, but he was a very experienced investigator. His protege, back at the Rockefeller Institute, is actually the person who found the influenza virus. But too late for Paul Lewis.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And that's not a pro forma comment. I mean it.
We've just been talking with John M. Barry. He is author of the book, The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History.